This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. While you OD on leftover VD chocolate, keep this in mind. Its uses go back centuries, including currency.
The seed of that tropical tree also was a kind of currency in the 1300s, 1400s, right before European contact.
Charlie Schlenker talks with an ISU anthropologist about the evolution of chocolate. It's the 50th anniversary of a play based on Shakespeare's Hamlet. Hear from the director of ISU's production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And get caught up on dining out in the Twin Cities. You'll hear from the man who runs the Facebook page, Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene. All of that, plus a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Many couples celebrated Valentine's Day this week with gifts of chocolate, but the sweet has a sometimes bitter and complex history. Illinois State University anthropologist Katie Sampeck looks at the genesis of taste and how chocolate came to be. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Sampeck says from the earliest uses of the cacao bean to the creamiest modern confection, chocolate embodies globalization.
Oh, the roots of that are really ancient, starting as early as, AD 400 or so. You have really widespread consumption of cacao-flavored foods and drinks all across Central America and Mexico. And the origins of that came from probably Amazonia and South America. So there are connections starting there. And cacao, not just to eat or to drink it, but the seed of that tropical tree also was a kind of currency in the 1300s, 1400s, right before European contact. So it was connecting people in this kind of global way. It united a lot of really disparate areas and places where people were fighting against each other, but they were using this cacao currency.
Where were the main cultivation areas just prior to the introduction of the Spanish?
In Central America, primarily, and in Mexico, especially the border area between Mexico and Guatemala, an area that was known as Soconusco. And it was so important. And here's some of these sort of global empire connections, that the Aztecs conquered that one little place just to have a direct line on access to cacao. And then when the Spanish arrived, there's this pocket of what eventually became colonial Guatemala. So it's today's western El Salvador and part of Pacific Guatemala. And that area evidently was a super producer. So there were just a few main big-time producers of cacao, and on the order of millions of cacao seeds every year being circulated around. And the Spanish step into this.
Makes it easy for government control.
Exactly, exactly. They just take over a system that was already there, and they use the cacao as currency.
Is it the main form of currency, or are there other?
It's the main form.
The other forms?
People paid their taxes, their tribute, and all of that in cacao. And in fact, they demanded cacao in different areas that didn't grow it, but they had to pay in it. The main reason for the Spanish love of the cacao currency is it was the small coin. If you go and you try to buy a hen and you've got something equivalent to a $100 bill, which would be a silver coin, you can't do it. It makes the commerce very difficult. Cacao worked like dollars and fives and that sort of thing in our currency today.
Europe was relatively late in the game in introducing caffeinated beverages, tea, cocoa, coffee. Why did the Spanish take a currency that was useful in Mesoamerica and say, hey, we've got an opportunity here in Europe?
I think that whole context of the native people were using it in all sorts of different ways, and that they had concocted all sorts of beverages and foods and a whole array of things that Europeans were very interested in. And it ties into ideas about health and also ideas, goals of colonization. So how do you incorporate these new people, these new places, and these new substances? And the problem, the dilemma that they had was this humoral idea of health, and that the climate that you're in, the soils that you're around, and especially the food that you ate could change you fundamentally. So today, all of these associations, say with Valentine's Day, and chocolate is this symbol or replacement for love. They saw that as a very, very real thing, just as that if you ate certain foods, it would give you certain qualities, characteristics. And so there was a lot of debate and interest. You know, can this make us better? Is this healthy for us? Is this good for us? Really, it actually moves pretty rapidly into there are early 16th century accounts of consuming this drink, and that they call it chocolate. And it tastes really terrible. But the more I drank it, the better I felt. And so they were very interested in capturing, you know, making that part of their world. And it became part of their world very quickly.
Why did it taste terrible?
I think it was the particular recipe that some of those travelers' accounts were sampling that they didn't care for it. Part of the work that I've done just really recently is look at pre-Columbian evidence of different sorts of recipes for cacao drinks and foods. And in fact, looking at pre-Columbian Maya texts, a lot of them are sweet. They describe sweetness, different kinds of sweetness. So a fruity sweetness, honey sweetness, and other sorts of qualities that we know today can be from the way the bean is handled and processed, can make it naturally sweet. And then you add a little sweetener to it, and wow, it's great. And so I think the European fondness for sweetness actually came from learning from Native Americans, because, say, the very first recipe for any use of chocolate in a French setting is as a sauce for a kind of duck. So it's a savory sauce with a bouquet garni and all of these other spices, and you add the chocolate to it.
About what year was that?
That was it's in the 1630s, okay, so very early. Oh, yeah, very early.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Katie Sampeck, who's a scholar of chocolate. There is early evidence, too, that consumption tended, at least in the early part of the history of chocolate, to be somewhat gender-linked in the early colonial era. Why is that?
I think that there's a difference between what gets emphasized and drawn out of all of the documentary and other sorts of evidence that we have, and art and so forth. And so in some ways it is gender-linked, because women, it becomes linked with sexuality and potency, that it can inflame passions, and that women are shifting in their roles in society. And so it becomes, women become the decadent consumers of this substance that can make them go over the edge or make them become so alluring that they overpower men.
Great for men. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And you have even Spanish Inquisition cases of people who are making what are known as hechizos, these love potions. And chocolate tends to be a very consistent ingredient in these love potions. And so women tend to be linked to that. But if you look really objectively at all the evidence and who's consuming what and who's making these love potions, it tends to be pretty balanced. And it's throughout the classes.
So then, as now, it's all marketing.
It is.
Continue along the line. How do we get from this humoral balance to actual chocolate and love and the stand-in for romance that we have today? Was it that developed early on, or when does it become that developed?
I think it's what we experience today has these really deep historical roots that we tend not to recognize. And chocolate is such a great example of one special preparation from one little place makes it big on the market. Partly because it's money, actually, but also because it's a particular taste that then people take up and they attach. Then debate about how moral it is, how it can improve us, if it's healthy for us, if it's sinful, what it should taste like, what time of day, and who should be eating it. All of these become these debates. So that today, when you say the word chocolate, it has all these immediate associations. But it takes a long time. It takes centuries.
Were there efforts to stamp it out because of its sinfulness, or because somebody didn't have market access and decided that they were going to gripe about it until they got market access?
That's almost a constant theme in chocolate history, that there's this griping and complaining throughout. So if you start with pre-Columbian evidence, it's the Aztecs taking over Soconusco so they can have direct access. And then from there, the reason why we even use this one word, chocolate, because there are lots of other cacao preparations, lots of beverages, lots of foods, perfectly pronounceable names. Chocolate is a Nahuatl word that's the same language family as Aztec, but it's a word that's really found and is the name for the drink that came from colonial Guatemala. So that becomes popular when it hits it big on the market. And then the fights become, well, who produces the best quality cacao and who should have control of that? And should there be monopolies of that? And people in this area of Western El Salvador and Guatemala are proclaiming, we've got the best. This should be the main source on the market because we're the highest quality. And these upstarts that happen in the 17th century in Venezuela and in Ecuador, there's a shift from native-controlled high-volume production to enslaved labor in these other places where the environment's okay. It's just not been grown there in that way before. And so the complaints are, this is poor quality. It damages the health of people. You should prohibit it. It shouldn't be shipped anywhere. That it's going to be bad for the empire. And then even the consumption of it, too, becomes quite a debate about its sinfulness in that chocolate's used so many ways. Is it a food? Is it a drink? The key thing for Catholics was, does it break the ecclesiastical fast? So there were people who were sitting in Mass in the 17th century drinking cups of chocolate to pass the time until Mass was over. And and
so you can take your coffee.
Yeah,
the church.
Right. All right. Well, the bishop got really upset about it. And it's a wonderful story about the bishop prohibits this practice. The parishioners decide to go to rural churches to attend Mass so that they'd be out of
fewer rules.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, maybe they're not keeping such a, you know, watching us so closely. The bishop finds out about it. Then he proclaims that any priest serving Mass, administering Mass to people consuming chocolate will be excommunicated.
Wow.
So that was powerful.
That's a heavy stick.
That's a heavy stick. And then what happens to that bishop? Not too long after he issues this edict, he dies after drinking what is said to be a tainted cup of chocolate.
Sounds like marketing to me.
Yes. So people would kill for chocolate. They wanted to keep their chocolate. And then this story also becomes an illustration of divisions between Protestants and Catholics, because the people telling this story are people who converted to Protestantism and said, look, this is a healthy substance. We have no problems. People, and especially this was a British writer saying, in the English body, this makes us beautiful and strong, and we don't have all those problems that those Catholics have. And so it was a way to connect morality show political independence and proclaim sovereignty.
ISU sociology and anthropology professor Katie Sampack spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Sampack's contemporary work focuses on the often exploited producers of cacao. She says a little bit of education in the groves can make a huge difference in product quality and worker income. Sampack talks about chocolate the evening of February 21st at the ISU Alumni Center. That talk is at 7 p.m. There will also be free samples of Askenosie Chocolate, a direct trade firm that tries to demystify the connection between farmer and product. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Candy, I call my sugar candy,
because I'm sweet on candy. And candy's sweet on me.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
Still to come during today's edition of Sound Ideas, an update on the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. I'm Mike McCurdy. 2017 marks the 50th anniversary of a classic of existential comedy. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead debuts tomorrow at the Illinois State University Westhoff Theater. The play gives a view of Shakespeare's Hamlet from the perspective of two minor and somewhat dim-witted characters. Laura Kennedy has more with the show's director.
When the characters of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern take center stage, they do so in an attempt to make sense of the world around them and to try to face what is inevitable for everyone. Paul Denhart is the director of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and he says he loves this play because it's based on his all-time favorite play, Hamlet, and it features Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who he thinks tend to get overlooked and not valued for the pivotal role they play in the drama.
Which is friends of Hamlet who betray him and sell out to curry favor with a new king. And so it's, I think, a devastating loss for Hamlet. And in this version of the play, they're here, but they really don't know what's going on. And they're kind of people pass through and in and out, and they're confused. They're trying to figure it all out and eventually wind up dead.
Yeah, because, spoiler alert, it's in the title. So don't get upset with us, please. It's an existential comedy.
It is. I mean, Stoppard, I brought a little quote from Stoppard, if I can read it. He says it's about two people who are knocking about inside the finite parameters of an invented story invented by William Shakespeare. They have roles to play. They don't really know what's going on in the story in which they become involved. They're not told what they're there for, what's really happening. And to my reading, they go to their deaths without ever having understood what the whole thing was about and why they are now dead. So if you like, it's about that. And even as I'm explicating it to you, I can see that's quite a kind of promising myth for ourselves and our lives. That, you know, we're here, we don't know everything that's going on, a lot of what we're told is lies, and we try to make sense of things, we try to preserve ourselves, and we die. How cheery.
So we get this worm's eye view of Hamlet from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and I remember reading it, and the very beginning, they kind of seem like empty vessels at the beginning.
Yeah, they're in a place, Stoppard describes it as a place with no visible character. They have really no visible character. We don't hear their names for quite a while into the play. And they're tossing coins, so they have this incredible string of, like, you know, 85 to 90 tosses of heads in a row. So right away, reality's turned a little upside down. I mean, that's not natural. And so they find themselves displaced in time and in reality. And I kind of think of it like what we're really seeing is, you know how your life flashes before your eyes when you're dead? It's like they pulled the lever and the trapdoor went and they went down and they hit. And before they die, they remember all this.
There is a lot of theatricality in this play. They break the fourth wall. You know, they're not too worried about everybody in the audience knowing this is a play. There's a lot of theatricality, especially when the players start coming in.
The players are just a collection of characters. And we're playing a lot with gender identity in this. And we have women playing players who are cross-dressing as men. One woman's kind of in between men who are cross-dressing as women. I mean, Stoppard calls them transvestite prostitutes. We're setting this in in the 20s, 30s in Europe. And there was this kind of cross-dressing movement going on back at the time, kind of, think cabaret decadence.
Yes.
And he's blurring the lines between the actors who then interact with the audience, sometimes move into the audience. And so in the close confines of Westhoff Theater, we have removed some of the seats so that actors can move behind the audience, through the audience, and even sit in the midst of the audience.
So you're really taking advantage of the Westhoff space. It's not a traditional proscenium theater. Are you using the thrust application then?
It is the thrust application, and you know, kind of a la Brecht. We're not trying to hide the lighting instruments. We're not, everything is exposed. The whole back wall of the theater is exposed for the first two acts. And indeed, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Stoppard has places in the play where they obviously are direct addressing or at least referring to the audience, and we've said, well, let's just run with that. I don't want to give anything away, but expect the audience should expect to have the actors close in proximity and maybe talking directly to them.
Well, this play is very witty. There's a lot of like back and forth dialogue, and I get the impression this has to be really crisp. It has to move.
Yeah, I told them it's like West Wing on speed.
Oh, man.
You know how in West Wing they would be walking and talking and everything's very fast and you're just keeping up. And that's what I'm playing with here. And I also, okay, I'm going to say this. I hate park and bark theater. I hate when actors just stand stock still and just talk. And, you know, I believe in the primacy of words, but I like to see the actors moving. And so we're constantly in motion, and we're speaking at a very brisk pace, and I think the audience will appreciate that. I think we're going to have a quick and entertaining and engaging evening in the theater.
Even though they may be moving, they're not really going anywhere.
Well, that's part of the joke, right? We have them going in circles and around the audience, and they never quite make the exit until the end of the play. And
it's the ultimate exit off this mortal coil.
That's it. You know, I mean, there's, for all the compasses in the world, there's only one direction, and time is its only measure. And they run out of time.
Now, does the play suggest that we can overcome the randomness of the world, or are we powerless?
Well, you know, do we have free will? There's a moment where they say, could we made another choice? Is there a moment when we could have turned this way instead of that way? And there, I don't know that it answers that question. I think it leaves it for us to ponder as we exit the theater, which is, as Stoppard says in the play, every exit is just an entrance someplace else. So I'm hoping that people will exit the theater going, what in the heck was that all about? What, you know, and ask these questions. Do we have free will? Do we truly have choice? Are we at the whims of the wind and fortune? Or is there anything we can do to change that?
Do you feel the ideas such as those of this play will be especially appealing now in this moment in our history?
Well, you know, this is indeed an interesting moment in our history where some of us do feel, I believe, that we've been left adrift and that a direction we thought we were moving in is suddenly amongst the shoals and our course is not certain. So I think, yeah, I think it's very timely in terms of also, I mean, just the idea of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern selling out their friend for political favor. There's political intrigue throughout Hamlet and in fact, a kind of usurpation of the throne. Did I say that? I think I did.
You did.
Yes.
Very
and,
well.
And so I think there's parallels to what's going on in our country today.
Well, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are not driving the action of the play. Is this a comment from Stoppard on passivity?
Well, it's interesting because they are passive, but then they start to drive it in terms of trying to figure out, not always effectively, what is happening to them? Why are they here? What are we ever going to know what the meaning of this all was? Did we die for nothing? I don't know that Stoppard says, yes, we definitely have free will. I think it's a question.
Is this a tragedy? And if it is a tragedy, is it a special kind of tragedy with all the humor?
Well, you know, I don't know. Stoppard thought it was a comedy. And even in his notes in the beginning of the script, he says, you know, when I wrote this, I thought it was really pretty funny, a funny situation. And I think it should be played humorously. And of all the productions in the world that have been done, there have been two that took it very seriously indeed and weren't very good. So, you know, how do we deal with this idea that we're here on this rock and it moves and we're moving, but we really have no control and we're going to die, and we deal with it with humor?
we see a lot in pop culture of a fascination with minor characters in movies and TV shows. I especially see this a lot in geek culture, where people obsess over, like, Admiral Akbar from Return of the Jedi and things like that. Do you suppose this play kind of spurred the current obsession with focusing on minor characters?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think Stoppard, that was part of the fun, was taking these two kind of unknown, very, very functionary characters in many ways in Hamlet and having them become the focus of kind of what's happening off. It's kind of like noises off, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, okay, this is what's happening off stage when all this Hamlet stuff is going on. And it's these two people who are kind of lost in this Escher-like castle, you know, never knowing which way to turn and where they're going to wind up.
That's Paul Denhard, director of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, opening tomorrow night and running through the 25th at Illinois State University's Westop Theater. Although Denhard is the fight director for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, he's leaving those responsibilities to another for this show. Graduate student John Tovar is the fight director for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Tovar was once a student of stage combat at Illinois State University. His instructor was Paul Denhard. I'm Laura Kennedy.
There's a pre-show to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead involving the characters of the tragedians who will hit the major points of Hamlet, priming the audience for the play to come. You're listening to music from Stephen Warbeck from Shakespeare in Love, co-written by Tom Stoppard. It's Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A long vacant restaurant is being rescued from the cold and dark in Bloomington. It's along Veterans Parkway. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene with Larry Carius about the former Carlos O'Kelly's, empty now for 3 years.
Oberwise Dairy's coming in to that spot, and they're essentially going to have two stores within one. I guess you walk in one door and you turn right and you will be in their dairy section in their ice cream store. You turn left and there will be a burger place. I believe it's called That Burger Place. The name Oberwise I've heard of for years as far as milk. I have never been to one of these stores. They have four of them in the suburbs. This will be the first one downstate. Kay and I are looking forward to going out and having a milkshake, Charlie.
This must be a first, because I'm actually ahead of you. I have been to the store in Aurora and had a shake, and it is quite good. It's a nice environment. It evokes the 1950s while being thoroughly modern.
From what I understand, they're going to be doing a major remodeling, and they're going to be putting a drive-through window in.
Fresh Thyme Farmers Market is going into Cub Foods space, or at least a portion of it. What's the update on their progress?
They're going in the south half of the former Cub Food space. This is a Meyer-owned company. It's kind of more along the Fresh Market concept. Just stopped out by there yesterday. The wood construction door was locked, but there was a knot hole, believe it or not. And I peeked it through the knot hole, and it looks as though the floor walls and ceilings are pretty well done. I believe now they're to the point they're going to be bringing the equipment in fairly soon.
As you peer through knot holes into the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene, I gather we're going to get a refresh on what's at the Park Regency Plaza.
Braze is going to be opening a second restaurant there. And Braze, as you know, Charlie, is just really an amazing story, in my opinion. They opened a Chicago equivalent of a pop-up restaurant in the VFW. When they told me the story, I went home and told Kay these guys were never going to make it, and I was absolutely wrong. They do a fantastic business at the VFW location. They're going to be going to the Park Regency, serving their burrito sandwiches and pizza and the various upscale bar foods.
That Far East Side location might present a challenge because there's not much of a population base to the east, but a number of places nearby have made it, so perhaps they can too.
Well, I think this will be a good location for them, Charlie. The tavern that they're going into is closed. I know it did not do well for a couple years. What I've learned is that the operators that are really sharp, really good operators, they look for locations that are down because they believe they can turn them into top flight locations. The tavern where they're going into, it's a modern place, has a modern kitchen, has a beautiful kitchen, has a nice bar, dining room. They just need to go in and to operate it properly, and I believe they will.
From the Far East Side, let's go to the Far West Side. What is the update on the Beningo's location?
Beningo's customers would not believe it if they would walk inside. The new owner, Bob Crawford, is the one I deal with. He is one of the partners. They went in there. They absolutely gutted the place. The only thing that was remaining from Beningo's was the cook line hood. They're going to be putting a neighborhood tavern in that will serve food. And I suspect we're probably looking at late spring or so before they open.
Tell us Bob's motivation. He's been a West Sider, but can anything really replace Beningo's?
I don't think he's trying to replace Beningo's in that he wants to support the West Side. He grew up two blocks away from Beningo's. Two of his sisters work there. Bob still lives like four blocks away from Beningo's. He and his partner have had vested interests on the West Side. They really didn't want to see an empty building there. I think it's kind of been Bob's dream off and on to own a tavern. This was an opportunity for him not only to go in and follow his dream, but to help the West Side with a nice investment.
Well, that's a new owner. Here's another one. Beth Olson is taking over the Copper Top Lounge. What are her prospects?
Beth, she was the general manager at the Treehouse Lounge for about 10 years or so. Gary Biddle owned both the Treehouse and the Copper Top. The Treehouse building was sold about a year ago, so Gary had to close the Treehouse. He moved Beth over to the Copper Top to be his general manager over there. They worked a deal where she has become owner of the Copper Top. The Copper Top was maybe a little on the tired side. Beth is coming in with some really nice ideas. She's a nice person. She works hard. I think she will do very well there.
Beningo's and the Copper Top are icons of times past. What about times past?
Art Donaldson, the owner of Times Past Inn. In 2017, he hopes to sell the Times Past Inn and retire. And Art has an extremely successful business there. He has done very, very well over the years. I forget how many years he's told me he's been in the restaurant business, maybe 35 or 40. He's like all of us, Charlie. He gets a little tired after a while, and he thinks maybe it's time to sell and retire.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Larry Karius of the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. It's cold out. It's winter. People like soup. When it's cold out, what soups do people like in town? From where?
We have not had a lot of cold weather this winter, but the one day that it reached zero, I just threw a survey out there on what are your favorite places or what are your favorite soups. The locally owned soup places that really did well on the survey, and I don't think there was any surprise in these. Shanna's did very well. Kelly's Bakery in downtown Bloomington did. Epiphany Farms, Garden of Paradise, the Garlic Press, and just to throw in a plug for Epiphany Farms, one of Kay's favorite soups is the pumpkin volute at Epiphany Farms.
Workers on the south side of Bloomington Normal around Veterans Parkway and Morrissey Crossing, or what used to be Brantville, are soon going to have another lunch option. How significant is that?
There's going to be an Arby's coming to Morrissey Crossing, and from what I understand, there's going to be a three-unit building built on the northeast corner of that property. One of the three units will become an Arby's.
Larry Caria says that will be the fourth Arby's in Bloomington Normal. The others are at Empire and Tawanda on the far west Market Street in Bloomington and on Rab Road in Normal. Larry Caria spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. He writes about the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene on a Facebook page with the same name, where more than 15,000 people follow him. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. Learn how you can make an impact at ilprairiecf.org. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Just last week, pet food maker Evinger issued a partial recall on a popular product in its beef line of dog foods. One dog died and several more were sickened by the presence of phenobarbital, a chemical used to euthanize animals. The chemical was present in meat that came from a longtime Evinger supplier who used phenobarbital to euthanize their cows. Evinger has since cut ties with that supplier, and just yesterday, PetSmart issued a nationwide recall of its Great Choice adult dog food due to a metal contamination that could pose a possible choking hazard. A number of pet food recalls over the years have given pet owners a queasy feeling about what actually goes into that can or bag of food, and in some cases, there are ingredients that, while they haven't forced a recall, aren't necessarily the best thing you can give your pets. In fact, some pet food ingredients are downright a bad idea. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of Animal House.
Listen to most of today's pet food commercials, and you'll hear a lot about ingredients.
Made with the finest natural ingredients, Blue Freedom has no grains, no glutens.
Fish, the deboned chicken, as opposed to cornmeal and byproducts, and I would rather see brown
delicious
rice.
Real meats, fruits, and veggies. And no fillers, meat byproduct meals, or artificial preservatives.
So is that really just so much marketing, guilting pet parents into paying extra for pet food? Turns out what goes into that can or bag is very important, but you've got to do your due diligence to make sure you're getting the right food for your fur baby. Jesper, manager of Premium Pet Supply in Bloomington, says interest in pet food ingredients is a trend that began as a slow-growing movement.
That started taking off once they started being massive product recalls with defective products, and that's what made the consumers really interested and more engaged to find out what they're actually feeding their animals.
Are we really out there on our own with trying to understand and decipher what's on a pet food label? Is it that difficult for us?
The information out there is conforming to federal standards, but at the same time, it's not necessarily easy to decipher what that all means. For instance, if you're listing a meat product in different forms and in different places on your ingredient list, that will overall change how much proportion-wise is in your food, and that is kind of difficult to determine on your own.
Oftentimes we see something listed called byproducts. What is a byproduct?
Byproduct would be anything that could be considered your primary meat meal is going to be based off mostly protein, fat, and moisture, and then depending on which form you're using, that will determine that. Byproducts would be anything that's essentially left over. That could be a sliver of skin, it could be cartilage, it could be organ meat. It really depends on how byproduct meal is listed. If it, for instance, is saying chicken byproduct meal, it's whatever is left over from slaughter of a chicken. Now, if it just says meat byproduct meal, we don't know where the meat is coming from. It could be any source.
Is this something we need to be concerned about as consumers?
I would definitely avoid any food that says meat byproduct meal, because the scary version is that it could be roadkill, zoo animals, sick cattle. It could be absolutely anything.
And does the government have any problem with it might being roadkill or zoo animals?
No, it's
just as long as it's identified in a certain way.
As long as it's identified from what it is, it doesn't really matter where it's coming from. It is being cooked. So that technically renders it safe for animal consumption, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to feed that to my animal.
Well, let's take a look. We're standing right next to bags and bags and bags of pet food. Here's one that's, it's blue, and blue, I see a lot of their advertisements talk about the ingredients in pet foods. As soon as I can find the ingredients. Here we go. And that's, there has to be at least 50 different things listed on here. And the first thing is deboned chicken. Seeing that as the very first ingredient means that's what's in there more than any other ingredient, correct?
Correct. When they list ingredients based on order of appearance, so when it says deboned chicken, that's going to be your primary source of protein. The tricky part comes into whereas deboned chicken will have, you'll have skin, meat, and fat itself. And what that means is that by weight, that is protein content is relatively low. What you'll find too is that they'll also put chicken meal in a food, and chicken meal is where you take chicken and you render the moisture out of it, so you get a much more concentrated protein out of it.
And it's actually listed, chicken meal is listed second on here. And the third ingredient, and the fourth, and the fifth are grains. We have brown rice, we have barley, and oatmeal. How important are grains in pet food?
There is varying camps to that. There's two sides to it. Some people think that grain is important. Some think it's not because it's not naturally a big part of a dog's diet. But at the same time, dogs have been domesticated for so long that there is really no close counterpart in a house versus running out in the wild. They have completely different makeups at this point.
Don't we have to be concerned about our dogs and our cats getting enough fiber in their diets so they stay regular? Is this something that's necessary when we look for ingredients?
Absolutely. And normally, if a dog was living outside in the wild, if he would be eating grass, berries, he'd be munching on a twig, bark, and things like that, which would provide him a source of fiber and help him out.
If it's a really long list of ingredients, that's not a bad sign necessarily, is it?
A lot of dog food manufacturers, to be able to maintain vitamin and mineral levels consistently, will use vitamin and mineral supplements. There's very few foods on the market that will use whole ingredients, herbs, fruits, and vegetables to get you the same nutrients. So when you start reading the list, once you get past, say, the first six or seven items, they become less important, but the long list is from the vitamin and mineral supplements.
Jesper, do we need to be concerned about colors or dyes in our pet food?
In certain cases, I generally prefer to avoid anything like that. It doesn't really make any difference for the dog itself. A dog could care less what the food actually looks like. That is more for the consumer. If you have a brightly colored food, it looks like it's fun for the dog, but it's completely unnecessary.
When you have something like this, which has deboned chicken as the number one ingredient, and they're really pushing how important protein is in the pet's food, is having a high protein diet sometimes not the best thing for our animals? Could that cause, say, kidney issues?
There's kind of two sides to that. There is some evidence that a high protein diet could be damaging the kidneys, and some say it's not. But if a dog has kidney problems or is prone to kidney problems, then you probably want to avoid the high-protein diet. But there's also research suggesting that high-protein diet does not cause kidney problems. So I think it comes down to a very species-specific question. And if you know the bloodline of where your dog is coming from or previous health issues further down the line, that can help you make a decision what you're looking for.
And you should probably talk to your vet as well if you're concerned about a particular type of food you should be giving your dog or cat or what have you, that you need to know what to avoid by talking to your vet.
Absolutely, you should discuss things with your vet, but it's also a good idea to do research on your own so you have questions to bring to your vet, and you can also set up periodic blood work to see how things are functioning on a normal level.
What does it mean, Jesper, when a food is labeled natural? Is that a tricky term for us to decipher as consumers?
Whenever you say natural, there's really no set definition of to what natural is, because everything that's in a dog food inherently does come from nature. So it's more of a marketing gimmick.
That's Jesper, manager of Premium Pet Supply in Bloomington. He says, above all, the pet food ingredients you should avoid at all costs are wheat, corn, soy, and anything that says byproduct meal. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have a question for one of the Animal House team of experts, you can email it to us at wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Jazz Up Front, Diggers, and Rosies are bringing a taste of Mardi Gras to downtown Bloomington during Fat Tuesday. Jazz Up Front will be the starting point of a second-line parade led by the Prairie Land Dixie Band. Jazz Up Front owner James Gaston told GLT's John Norton that each venue will have food and drink along the way, and he said rain, snow, sleet, or shine, Fat Tuesday in Bloomington will include a second line.
A young lady by the name of Julie came to me and she said, you know, we ought to have a big Mardi Gras party. And we were just bouncing ideals around. And I said, you know, we should get everybody on Front Street involved in this thing. And you know what? We could second line to down Front Street with the band and everything. And she said, second line, you know, what is that?
Okay.
And so I explained to her what second line was, and everybody thought, oh, you know what, that's a great idea. So we put together a few people, and we just planned this whole thing out, and we think it's going to be a great party. Yeah.
Where is everyone going to meet, and where are you headed to?
Well, we're going to meet at Jazz Up Front at 107 West Front Street, downtown Bloomington, probably around, well, anytime they want to get here. We're going to actually leave Jazz Up Front at 5:30 to second line down to the other end of Front Street, which is where Diggers is.
So you're going to cross Main Street?
Yes, we're going to cross Main Street.
Okay.
I think we might have a police car with us to make sure nobody gets
It's probably
over.
A good idea.
But, yeah, we're going to cross Main, or East Street. It's actually East Street.
I get them all mixed up.
Well, actually, we're crossing Main and East. Okay. But Main's not going to be that big a deal.
It's East Street's the one. Okay.
With the four lanes coming at you, that's the one we're concerned about. The city offered us a possibility of having a squad car kind of go along with us just because it's, you know, we're hoping for a big crowd.
So did you need a permit to do something like this?
No, we don't. I checked with the assistant city manager, and he said that, you know, as long as we keep everybody on the sidewalk, we're fine.
Okay. All right. So the Prairie Land Dixie Band is going to lead the parade. You've got a second line. Who are you hoping is going to join? How many people do you want? How many, you know, anybody can join?
It's open to the whole community, and we hope a lot of people in downtown participate, because that's what the whole project's about, is bringing more awareness to downtown Bloomington and especially Front Street.
Are you going to have the band playing inside before you go down there?
Yes, the band's going to start playing probably around 4, and then we're going to take off from here about 5:30 and march down Front Street all the way to the other end. The band's going to come in Diggers with us, and you know they're going to play a little bit in there, and then we're going to come back and stop in Rosie's. I don't know. I hope they could play in Rosie's, but, you know, if they're having a dinner hour or something, you know, I don't know. We'll see how that works out.
Well, this has been a huge tradition down in New Orleans, where it is set up ahead of time, where you stop in a different restaurants, different bars, and it's all set up ready to go. It sounds like you've got the same situation here. Are you hoping this maybe starts to trend in here up in the north? We get to have a little Mardi Gras fun outdoors.
Right. We're praying for good weather, and, you know, we're hoping we get a big crowd, and we hope to make it an annual event.
Do you want other people coming in with instruments, or do you just want people following along with the Prairie Land Dixie Band?
I would say just let the band do their thing. Yeah, I don't know. I guess that'd be up to the band if, you know, other people could bring instruments. I hadn't thought about that, to be honest with you.
Listening to music from the Prairie Land Dixie Band. They're going to lead a second line on Fat Tuesday on February 28th in downtown Bloomington from Jazz Up Front. We're talking to the owner of the club, James Gaston. So let's talk a little bit about Jazz Up Front. You've been in place now for, what, a couple of years?
May will be 2 years.
Two years in May. Yeah. So, I mean, we think it's kind of cool. The Castle Theater established themselves, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. A lot of people said, I don't know if they're going to make it, but they have. You've been here a couple of years now with jazz. How is it going for you?
Well, you know, it's going pretty good. You know, we can always use more business, but some days I look like I really know what I'm doing, and there's days that I kind of wonder about it. But we've gotten a big, good following from the community. There's a lot of jazz lovers here. I would love to see all of them come a little more consistently, but we have some loyal supporters that, you know, that keep us going.
As we're speaking, last weekend you had the Illinois Wesleyan Jazz Festival people down here as well. You want to talk a little bit about how that went?
That was fabulous. We were blessed to put that deal together. Glenn Wilson brought me that opportunity. The Dardens.
Darden Purcell.
Darden Purcell and Sean Purcell. They were fabulous. And Dave D'Angelo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, fabulous. Glenn did a great job. The whole band was great. I mean, it was a good experience. The place was packed. I was really impressed with it. It worked out really good.
So if you don't mind me asking, jazz across the country is having a tough time. It's had a tough time, you know, in different areas. But there's a certain kind of group that probably does well for you, even here in Bloomington Normal.
Well, I like to think of Jazz Up Front as a place that welcomes younger people. But, you know, our main crowd is probably people that are older. And we've carved out a little niche of people that really love jazz, thanks to GLT and other support from the community. And there's enough people in town here to support one jazz club, I believe. You know, I mean, a lot of places, you know, dabble in jazz.
Yeah.
You know, they'll have jazz here and there. But, you know, we try to focus mostly on jazz and blues. We do some blues, too. But.
Well, it's nice to have a little bit of culture in the Twin Cities. You know, slowly we're getting there, right?
Right. We, you know, we get a lot of people that come in from out of town, you know, with help from places like the McLean County Museum and stuff like that. They send people here. People send people here from all over town because they're asking, where is there some place to go for an older person to listen to some live music and have a good time? And Jazz Up Front always comes up. So we've been very fortunate with that.
James Gaston from Jazz Up Front. We're looking forward to a little bit of Mardi Gras here in the Twin Cities on the 28th.
I'm looking forward to it.
This is a great idea.
Yeah, I think it's going to work out. I mean, you know, we're always trying to think of things to keep it lively in downtown Bloomington, and I think this is another promotion that could develop into something that we can do every year, and I think people have a great time, and that's what it's all about, entertaining the community, if we can do that.
Jazz Up Front owner James Gaston speaking with GLT's John Norton. You can purchase tickets for Fat Tuesday Second Line Parade in downtown Bloomington at Jazz Up Front, Diggers, or Rosie's. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories you heard today at our website, along with the full show podcast and archive. Tweet about GLT's Sound Ideas. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy.